The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pot of thunder and rock and roll. And here we go. Are you ready? It's the Duff McKagan joke of the week.
Hey, Chris Jericho. Duff McKagan. I have a joke about a boomerang. Hold on. It'll come back to me. Thank you. Goodbye.
That's not bad. Not bad. Little Larry David there. Ladies and gentlemen, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Duff McKagan from Guns N' Roses. I think he should keep his day job. But actually, he's doing pretty good on his side job here, working with the joke of the week on Talk is Jericho. We love you, Duff, and we love all your bad dad jokes. Wouldn't be TIJ Friday without you, but since it's Friday, and it is UK week right here on Talk is Jericho, let's get the weekend party started with another great vocalist, another great rock and roller, former Iron Maiden singer Blaze Bailey. You'll hear the story of how he came to front Maiden after Bruce Dickinson originally left the band during the height of Maiden's popularity. And you'll hear how Blaze found out he was no longer in Iron Maiden because Bruce and Adrian Smith were both coming back. It's kind of a surprise for him. Blaze got some great stories about touring with Maiden, writing and recording two albums with them, what it was like working creatively with Steve Harris. He also has one big regret about his time in Maiden. He's talking about that as well. Plus, Blaze just released a new solo album and is touring Europe this summer. You hear the story all behind Infinite Entanglement Part 3, the last in a trilogy of records that he's been writing and recording for the last 3 years. So, let's get to the rock and roll. Blaze Bailey right here on Talk is Jericho starts now.
Do you want a mic stand or
something?
Well, no. Over the years, I've developed the strength to hold a mic.
You have the strength. Yes, you can hold the mic in your hand like a mic
performer. I don't need it.
So it's funny, though. You mentioned we're here in a hotel in Birmingham with Blaze Bailey. And this started, okay, we've met a few times before.
Yeah, over the years. I think we met in New Jersey the first time. One of your very first things that you ever did as a singer, a metal fest there. Was it Milwaukee?
New Jersey Metal Fest. It was at the place, it was at the Cricket Club.
Yeah.
It was like apocalyptic.
Yeah, and it was you, it was me, it was Behemoth before they went up a notch, mm-hmm, you know, and became international. It was one of your very, very first things. I remember meeting you backstage then, man. That was a big weekend for me.
Yeah.
And
it's funny because I remember
really
that
cool.
Place was like I said, something from Escape from New York. It was like this horrible neighborhood, and there's a big chain link fence around this venue. Remember that with like some barbed wire on the top or something?
And it was all the local houses were wooden construction. And it seemed bizarre to me. Where you come out of the, you know, New York City, and there's all this bizarre, and it's just such an, well, you know, with great respect to the people that live there, it seemed like a difficult place to live.
It was an awful looking place, yeah. I remember, yeah.
But, I think that was the first time we met
that one.
many years ago.
So there's a little bit of a history, but I'm walking down the street a couple months ago in L.A., and I just happened to be walking past the, I was going to the Rainbow, and I walked past the Whiskey, and I see Blaze Bailey playing on, you know, the 8th. I'm like, oh, what day is it? It's the 8th. What time is it? It's 11:30. I go, you guys are about 5 or 6 songs into the set. I just happened to walk by, walked inside, and it was so much fun. It was a great show.
Oh, thanks, man.
And it was great to see you there randomly.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the wheels start spinning. We meet.
Yeah.
Here we are today. But was that your first U.S. tour for a while?
Yeah, it's the first opportunity that I had to go to the U.S. and do a full tour with my own band. Mm-hmm. I've been there many times before. I've been a guest singer and, you know, done odd spots. I've taken my band there, different versions of it, for one or two shows, but I've never managed to tour the US a full tour with my own band, and it's something I've always wanted to do since the Wolfsbane days was the last time, really. And it just came together for me. I had a lot of luck and a lot of support from some great fans, and we managed to get it together. So that was like the end. That was the last week of the tour. And I think I played the Whiskey like 30 years ago. And I'm like, it's just hardly changed at all inside.
Same couches in the dressing room. Yeah.
I think the original guys working there on the sound of light are probably dead now. You know?
So if you go and get into the bus and go across the States, I mean, that's a long track.
It is, man. It's a huge country. It's vast, and obviously, I mean, it was one of my very, very favorite places to tour and play, but it's a country of very tough competitors, and it's just difficult. So, but you know, I had a lot of luck. I've had some great fans there and loyal support for so many years, and people haven't been able to see me. And I've started working on the last four tours that I've done across Europe with the band Absolver as my backing band. And I really have built up a kind of rapport and telepathy with the band, as you know, working with your own guys. And I wanted to take those guys there with me and do what I do in Europe, in the US, and of course in the rest of the world. And so that was it. I kind of drew a line in the sand and said, no, next time I come, I'm coming with my own guys. And I'm going to do the full show that we do everywhere, that we've done 100 times every year. And we did. And it was great because fans who've been waiting to see me for like 10 years or more, they just got the best. They loved it. And to be able to sing at my best and be there performing with the musicians that I know so well, there's that rapport that you have that no one gets out of anybody's way when I'm on stage. We have this thing, which is you hold your ground and you don't step back because you feel intimidated by the audience, and you don't get out of your way if you feel intimidated by me. You just hold on. And the three of us across the front, man, we just hold on and hold on, and we grab people by the neck the best we can. And what we try to do is say, look, you're not here to watch us. You're here to participate in this show. This is your show. It's not me getting all these great vibes and feelings. Oh, tell me how great I am. It's not that. It's us rejoicing and living in these moments of music that we both love. And that's what we try to do, is to wake people up, take them out of their normal life, reach inside their chest, grab their heart, drag it out bleeding, blow on it, and put it back in their chest and say, now, you're the same, but just a bit better.
That's so important, because we have the same type of show. We ask a lot of our audience as far as being participating and being involved and being energetic. But that's where you have the best shows.
Yeah.
And coming in, like I said, literally walking in off the street and being a fan of your records, both with Maiden and without.
Yeah.
I've never seen you live.
And that
was the fun part. Like, there was a lot of fun going on. And that's sometimes in rock and roll, it's fun is almost a dirty word. But it was a whole lot of fun that night.
Yeah, I think it's a shame that sometimes people have to appear to be so earnest. My show goes from the darkest melancholy and despair, which I talk about in some of my songs. It's obvious that it's about my own depression and things like that. Other elements of my music are about taking control of your life, about having your future in your own hand, about not believing in destiny, not believing in fate, but creating your future, not being a piece of driftwood on the ocean, but making your own boat. And it's that kind of thing. And then saying, well, we all know why we're here and we're going to have fun as well. So I think if you know a person, sometimes your best friend, you'll go out and you'll tell your troubles, the woes of your life. And other times you have a great laugh and a great crack and a few drinks. And for me, that's what the show is supposed to be like, that I will open up and I will reveal to you what is inside and the darkness that's there, but also the struggle that's there to try and continue, as difficult as it is in music to continue to try and keep that going. But it's not a struggle that's unique to music to try and achieve any dream, however humble it is. I don't see my dream of being a professional musician as being particularly grand, but it has been difficult. But it's just as important if you aspire to build your own motorcycle or even ride a motorcycle or be a good parent or be great at your job. That is a worthy dream if it's yours. And I think to try and connect with my audience and say, look, your dream, however humble it is as important to me as my own dream. But I'm actually living my dream when I'm on stage. People might think, oh, but you're not playing stadiums. Well, excuse me, it may not sound particularly fashionable, but I don't want to. I've played stadiums. I've played the biggest gigs that I can play. I've played in front of 70,000 people. I've played in front of 50,000 people a night, 10,000 people a night. I want to play in smaller places. I still enjoy doing festivals, but mostly I want to play in smaller places where I can touch you, where the important thing for me is at the end of the show, I get to say thank you. I do a free meet and greet at every show with no limit on the amount of items that you can sign. And I meet every single fan that wants to meet me and have a photo with every single fan, because for me, my dream has come true and those people keep my dream alive. So I'm so lucky, man.
But in this day and age too, like when you're touring across the states, and I know it for a fact, you know, it's expensive. And a lot of the ways to put gas in the tank is by a VIP package, a meet and greet.
Yeah.
You don't do any of you do yours for free.
For me, I don't see any problem with doing that. If people want to do that, if that's how they need to do it. The music business has changed drastically. In the 30 years that I've been in the music business, you would be able, when I started, to have a show that cost more than the gross income from the tour. And it would be supported by sales of records and CDs.
Right.
And you would go out there with a classic thing of, let's look big and we will become big, spending more than you would gross on the tour. Well, since those days have gone, when I joined Iron Maiden, EMI closed all of their manufacturing facilities that year. So what does that tell you? That they believed the future of the music business would be. So none of that income is available anymore. There is no big income from CDs and, you know, selling millions of actual pieces of things that are made by people. So you have to find a way to get that income. For me, what I choose to do is live a humble life, keep my overhead low, live in a small house, have a reasonable motorcycle, and my life is living for that music. So I don't really need to go and ask people that have already paid the ticket for the extra money. For some people, they do need that. It's a way, it is very expensive. The other thing is I rough it, man, when I'm on tour. I don't stay in good hotels. I stay in, like, when I've got a red roof in, you know, that's like luxury for me. So I'm like, so I rough it, man. And we don't have any crew. We do everything ourselves.
Ah, okay.
We drive ourselves. We do everything ourselves. And it's a different way of doing things. And not everybody is comfortable or can even do that. But for me, that's the way I've chosen to do it. It's a way of life. It's not always easy, but it is still the dream.
That's what you want.
That I'm living, and I just meet so many people, so many great people. I have so much support because I'm able to arrive outside the gig. A fan will be sitting there, and the next thing, we'll be talking about motorcycles, and it'll say, "Hey, well, I got a bike. Do you want to come over to my place? We'll go for a ride." Yeah. Okay, you know, and in my old life, in the big, when I was in a really big band, that would never happen.
Sure, it can happen.
It would never happen. I meet so many wonderful, wonderful people. And also, the other thing that I try and do is I always try and go back to places that I like and never return to places that I don't like. So if they don't care about the sound at the venue, and I don't care what the prestige of the venue is, and if they don't respect the fans, I never return, man. There's a prestigious gig in Barcelona where I said to them before that, look, I have to have time to do this meet and greet. This could take an hour. So you better be telling me that no one's going to get thrown out when I start signing. That's it. And this, oh no. And then after about four people, the security start coming up. Two items. I'm like, what? I never said
that's
that.
Not your thing,
and man. Then five people. No, that's it. The signing's finished. I'm like, what? So I had to go outside and sign outside the venue for my fans. So I never return to there. And another gig in Buenos Aires. The instant that the gig was finished, they emptied the room. So I had to go outside on the street in Buenos Aires with 300 fans alone with no security because the security were too scared to stand next to me and sign by myself for 300 fans on the street in Buenos Aires. And I had to break up two fights that started. Oh, stop it now! I'm pretty loud, you know, when I need to be. But I done it, man. Every one of those fans got a photo and an autograph. But that's just the way I am, man. That's the way I am. That's just me. And really, I don't think it means much. I don't think it gets me. It makes people like me more or get me anywhere. It's just something in me that where I've been, that the highs and the absolute lows that I've been through. And man, when I had nothing, I was just working a regular job after I spent all my money for my maiden trying to make it with my own band.
Wow.
And I just didn't get anywhere. My Silicon Messiah album completely bombed. Mm-hmm. My 10th Dimension album failed. My live album didn't do well, and my Blood and Belief album, just nothing happened as well. So there I was completely broke in those years, but I still get emails and letters from fans saying, please carry on, please continue, please keep making music, I love your music. So I see it, for me personally, it's a personal debt of gratitude that I owe to the fans that kept me going. And you know, man, when things are rough, then I look at my Facebook and I look at the comments that I get, and you think, yeah, I'm going to keep going. I'm going to keep going. I can do it. I can do it. And people believe in me, and they tell me they believe in me. It keeps me going.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed, also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Let's talk about this for a bit. You mentioned about Maiden joining the band, biggest band, heavy metal band in the world.
Fantastic.
If it's not Metallica. You know, I mean, let's just talk about
that. Before Metallica, it's
bigger.
Absolutely. Yeah. In legendary status at that time, no one had ever done what Iron Maiden had done. Come from there to get to there. Not even Priest had managed to sustain.
I agree, yeah.
That level, it's just business. It's just fact, so you know.
Do you grew up a Maiden fan?
I was a Maiden fan. I was a Priest fan. More Maiden than Priest, and AC/DC and Rainbow and all the classic metals, you know, that we used to listen to, guys our age. And it's just...
So about you, because you did Wolfsbane, and I had a Wolfsbane album in Canada in about 1992 or 3, as on Deaf American Records. And suddenly here comes Bruce Dickinson leaving in 94 or whatever it was.
Yeah, Bruce obviously felt, I mean, I've never really spoke to him about him leaving, but it's pretty obvious that he had to have a change in his life. You know, mentally, he was suffering. He needed to make that change. It's a huge job that it's difficult to understand. You know, in sports, well, you've been at the top in your field in the sport that you do. So I often think of it in, like, in a soccer analogy that... you know, when I was in Wolfsbane, I was playing in the regular league. And maybe we were near the bottom most of the time, but we were doing what we do and we were just about scraping by and everything. And then when I was in Iron Maiden, then I was in the World Cup. And every single night was the World Cup final. And you were expected to win. And I think you know that kind of pressure what you've done, man, in your professional career in wrestling is just, you know, that kind of pressure.
Sure, yes.
That, and I think that is very, very tough. And I think for Bruce, being that long at the top, I mean, not just one of the legendary voices in metal, really, along with Rob Halford shaping what metal vocals were. If you think Bruce Dickinson, Rob Halford, Ronnie James Dio, and a couple of other guys just were the shape of metal vocals. And he's been there and a fantastic frontman for so many years at the top. I think in the end, it's very difficult to draw the line. If you haven't got yourself centered, then, well, are people talking to me because I'm the lead singer of Iron Maiden and I'm famous? Or are they talking to me just because I'm a regular bloke that you might say hello to? I'm actually an okay guy. And that is a very confusing thing. And I'd already been through that in Wolfsbane. I was so famous in the UK, in Wolfsbane.
You guys were big in the UK.
Well, yeah, and... we were very popular with the press. They liked us. So I was in every single magazine. I was recognized everywhere I went. Heavy metal was so big in those days. I'd already gone through this kind of crisis where you're going, well, why is that person talking to me? Mm-hmm. What are their motivations? Are they talking to me because they want to know something about Wolfsbane, or do I actually mean anything outside of the band that I'm in and my music? Am I a worthwhile person? I'd already been through that. And I think perhaps that was the time when Bruce was going through that. And, well, very lucky for me, it opened the door to just...
As you toured with me?
Yeah. I was so lucky, Chris. Absolutely as lucky as anything, because we had a video to go with our song I Like It Hot, and It was between Wolfsbane and the Almighty. And the guys from Maiden said, right, we're going to choose, we want a British support band. It's, I think it was 33 shows in the UK of the smaller venues wow. that they would never play
right.
again.
Right.
It was their last UK tour as what the old school way of doing it.
Heading to Wolverhampton, yeah, and Middlesbrough.
Exactly. And, yeah. Everywhere, right. man. Everywhere. So, anyway, they watched the videos, and the Wolfsbane video, we had football, in our, soccer in our video, and chicks, and we were just having a giggle most of the time, you know. And so they went, oh, they seem like they're up for a laugh, but we'll have them, they'll look like more fun. Right, right, right. So that's the, so we got that tour. And then, of course, yeah, I'm so competitive and pretty cheeky that every night I would just push it as far as I could, and I'd be going, I'd be getting in front of the monitors, I'd be climbing up on Bruce's side fills and all of that, where he used to climb up and all of that, and no one ever told me to stop, so I just kept going further and further as a support band, man. Absolutely, as long as you were on time and didn't touch the drum riser, you could do anything you wanted.
Wow.
And it was just crazy. We're running all over the place, climbing all up the side fills, jumping all over the monitors. Oh man, it's absolutely crazy. We were getting an encore almost every night, and I was invited to join the Iron Maiden football team.
Ooh,
yeah. Yeah, and get this one, how big, you'll know this, how big are you when you can have the Saturday off to play football? And if you're in rock and roll,
yeah, right.
you work every Saturday. Every Friday and Saturday is a gig. You can't afford to have Saturday off. No, no, we have Saturdays off. We're going to play football on the tour. Against the local teams from the venues. The local. Oh, man. Oh, it's still like the best tour I ever did. So Bruce left a little while after that tour, and I think the only advantage that I really had is I'd given them my CDs on tour and they'd actually seen me live. Mm-hmm. And I was able to get an audition for that gig as lead singer, and there was a lot of other guys up for it, and I think they decided on 12 guys for wow. the final audition. And you
was there anybody of any name value?
I don't know. Yeah, really, I don't know. They kept it very gotcha. Very close, and they didn't really tell me afterwards either. Mm-hmm. And so you learned 10 songs, which were the main 10 songs from the that were almost always in the set. So you had Trooper, Hallowed Be Thy Name, Fear of the Dark, Wrathchild, Heaven Can Wait. I think you had Clairvoyant.
Number of the Beast.
Yeah, Number of the Beast. All the classic yeah. ones that nor ought I made, obviously, that are normally in the set. Went to the audition and just did the absolute best that I could. And I've obviously made all my own notes, but learning it from another perspective, I'd also learned all of the drum fills and all of the melody parts of the guitars. So I knew every time that Nico was going to do a drum fill, I would look at him and I would know that that drum fill was coming. And of course, I knew what bass drums were. I'd studied it, man. And I just thought, you know what? Whatever happens now, for an hour, I am the lead singer with Iron Maiden. I'm just going to be it, man. I'm just going to own it. I'm just going to be it. And I didn't start. They had the monitor set up at the far end of the room. And I said, well, I really don't want to stand there. I need to stand near the drums because, you know, to get my time and everything. It's okay if I stand here. So I stood in the middle of the room with the guys. And I don't think anybody else did that. And had the monitor there and just, oh, man, I just absolutely went to town. I never thought I would get it. And they asked me back for a second audition, and that was in the studio recording. Well, as you know yourself, you've done a lot of recording, that live and recording are two different animals. It's like yeah. live is the spotlight, recording is the magnifying glass. So I did that. I think it was one of three guys that got that audition. And I remember saying to Steve Harris at the time, I said, Steve, I said, will I be able to get a copy of this? You know, he goes, I said, if I'm not successful at the audition, could I still get a copy of me singing in the studio? He goes, no, but we will send you a copy of the guy that gets it.
bastard.
As mad. And then, like a few weeks after that, I mean, it's a huge thing. So a few weeks after that, that's it. I got in touch. I think it was Christmas Eve. Mm. I said, yeah, you got it. Come to a meeting.
Wow.
And man, I bought myself a case of beer and a cordless phone. I was there, man. I was big in chocolate that Christmas.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your vocal style is different from Bruce's.
This is another reason I didn't think I would get it.
Yeah, it's a different mix, you know.
Yeah, and I think that difference, Chris, is one of the reasons that I did get it, because I think Steve heard something in my voice and he really wanted to change. He thought, well, he's had this voice of Bruce, which is a fantastic voice and really versatile for so many years, but there are elements of my voice and absolutely nothing like Bruce, and places that I just don't go, you know, that Bruce can go. And I think that was it. And if you listen to Sign of the Cross and The Clansman and Fortunes of War and Man on the Edge as well, if you listen to some of the big songs from that X Factor album, you can see that it's the beginning of the progressive era.
Agreed.
Of
Agreed.
Iron Maiden.
Absolutely.
And it marked a change. And obviously, I'm very proud to have been a part of that. But what I never anticipated was how generous in his time and energy that Steve Harris would be. And I've written a lot of songs before then. And then to work with someone who's got multi-platinum albums and gold albums all over his house. And when he says, well, try it this way. Well, if you do this, it could work a bit better. Or if you try, and he was a mentor to me, really, in many ways. And in the studio, we really found this other part of my voice, which is now the main part of my voice. So really, though I loved my work with Wolfsbane, I really found my full and true voice in Iron Maiden.
Mm-hmm. Which Bruce songs were the hardest for you to sing, just from a range standpoint?
I think that I love Clairvoyant, but there's a couple of parts of Clairvoyant that are particularly awkward. And yeah, I think that's...
What about like the iconic scream from Number of the Beast, which is very hard to do?
Yeah.
And it's so well known.
Yeah, it is, but as a vocalist, then there are techniques that you employ. One of the classic ones, of course, is at the beginning of Appetite for Destruction that Axl Rose made so famous, and that is a scream, which is really a kind of screech on the inhale and exhale that you make seem seamless. And of course, there is as well just the old-fashioned W word, work, and practice, and that's a big part of it, you know. And Eric Adams, the great Eric Adams from Manowar, I loved his vocal. So I'd actually developed and learned a scream that was kind of coming from the Dave Lee Roth Van Halen early era into the Manowar Eric Adams style. So I had a pretty solid scream up there that I could scream in tune, a very high thing. So it was an incorporating that, really,
right,
and working and practicing on it, you know. So there's no easy, you know, that one of my favorite sayings, I don't even know where it comes from. Well, the easiest way around it is to go right through it.
Yeah, that's it, huh? And let's talk about writing the X Factor, because you coming in as the singer, were the songs written already?
Chris, it's incredible. It was incredible. Steve said, no music is written for the album. There's nothing, not one single song, nothing is written. And he said, his exact words, I don't care who writes the music. It just has to be f***ing great music. And I was like, wow. And you know, as a songwriter with Wolfsbane, I have a lot of ideas, and being a big fan of Maiden, I went to Yannick Gers and I went to Steve Harris with all my ideas and melody ideas and lyrics and things like this, and we started to put the album together. And I think I've got six collaborations on The X Factor, and I think four collaborations on Virtual 11, which came after and before I actually moved on from the band. Before that, then, I had a lot of ideas that I thought would be wonderful for the third album that I was looking forward to working on, and they ended up being on my first solo album, gotcha, Silica Messiah.
I am a big fan of the X Factor record, even to the fact I did an interview a couple days ago for a book that someone's putting together. They get a bunch of quote-unquote famous people giving two favorite Maidens.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, what has so-and-so picked? And of course, everyone's picking Number of the Beast. And, you know, and I said, well, I'll do Powerslave and I'll do X Factor.
Yeah.
I bet you no one's done X Factor. I love how dark that album is.
Yeah.
And like you said, the beginning of the progressive stage of Maiden that still exists hugely to this day.
Yeah.
You know, it very dark, though.
Yes, it is. And of course, it's in the personal life, not going too deeply into it, a huge amount of turmoil and change for Steve Harris
or something.
Yeah, in his personal life, as well as he's lived for Iron Maiden, obviously, you know, just putting your family aside for a moment. He's lived for Iron Maiden for so many years, and at some points, he did consider that it may be the end of Iron Maiden, Bruce leaving. And I remember Dave Murray saying to me, well, yes, Steve did say to him one day, he said, oh, man, should we, is this it? Should we just hang it up now and just stop? And and Dave said, no, I'm still having fun. I'm still enjoying it. Forget it. No, we'll keep going.
The happiest guy in the world.
Yeah.
And he's always so happy.
That's it. So I think it was a lot of turmoil, a lot of darkness going on while we were recording, while the writing was going on. You know, management gave us as much time as you wanted. They said, we don't care a year. We don't care if this album takes a year to make. Just make the album that you want to make. And it was so cool. It was dark, you know. There was a lot of darkness there, but in a way, I suppose, because of the kind of person that I am, there is this melancholy and there is this darkness that I'm attracted to, and it still shows in my writing since Maiden. And I think one of the songs that I had, Fortunes of War and Look for the Truth. Mm-hmm. Look for the Truth is an amazing thing that is so unusual, but to be in a situation writing that song and feel it recorded with the drums of Nico and everything, and then months later to be in a hotel room just like this and in Poland, in Krakow, and to hear fans singing whoa outside that hotel. You can't imagine that feeling, man. That it's even almost bigger than having a top 10 hit with Man on the Edge. To actually hear those fans in a city I'd never been to, I never imagined in my life I would go to Krakow in Poland to perform a concert, to be there, and those hardcore Maiden fans singing a song that I wrote with Iron Maiden was incredible, man. It's just incredible, incredible feeling, and one of the proudest moments of my professional career. And just a moment in a hotel room listening to some fans singing, but a huge feeling of pride.
How was it for you? I mean, to kind of be, you've got a group of guys, including Rod Small, where there's five guys that have worked together for years.
Yeah.
Was it hard to come in as the new guy? Did they make it easy for you?
Yeah, I think they made it as easy as they could, but there is no easy thing about fitting into a team that has been doing things a certain way and moving a certain way and winning for so many years. And I had to adapt a lot of the ways that I did things from my past in Wolfsbane to the way that Iron Maiden did things. Mm-hmm. So, and Iron Maiden have changed over the years, man. They became so big, So when I was supporting Iron Maiden in Wolfsbane, Iron Maiden signed after every single show. But by the time I joined Iron Maiden, they were so big, it was just impossible to sign.
Mm. So you do signings after the shows?
After every single show on that tour up to No Prayer for the Dying, there was a signing after almost every show. But when I joined, there was hardly ever a signing. We had to, it was just too big. Mm-hmm. I mean, that the amount of time that would take to sign for the people that hung around after the Iron Maiden gig, you missed the next gig.
Yeah.
So for me, with my little shows now, it's very, very rare that, well, I don't sign after a show. I'll try and sign before a show if I think I'm going to miss the plane. Mm-hmm. I have to get to another city. I'm going to jeopardize the next show. Yeah. But in Maiden, you definitely would not make the next show if you stuck around to sign for everybody. So that was a big change from the Maiden that I knew before, and I was in that Maiden mm-hmm. that was so big that they couldn't stay.
What was the fan reaction like? Because I remember I worked a lot in Japan at the time, and Burn magazine had a big cover of you and you and Steve, and I remember just looking at this, like, you look crazy and cool. I mean, just to look at the sideburns, and we were a lot younger then. You had long hair, you know, and it just looked cool. Like, it looked like a good looking band.
Yeah.
What was the fans' reaction? I mean, obviously Bruce is gone, and you have to do the unenviable task of replacing this guy.
I think it's the girlfriend reaction, and nobody wants to admit it, but you always want someone to blame if your girlfriend leaves you for someone with a bigger car and a better job. You don't want to think that it could be for that reason. Mm-hmm. And you have to find someone to blame for that situation, whoever that is. So I felt that I had an incredible amount of support and well-wishing from so many fans that just wanted Iron Maiden to continue and go, and went, well, that's the singer they've chosen. We better live with it and get used to it, because we're stuck with him now. Yeah. So it's no point bitching about it. And there's another group of people, much smaller but much louder, that go, we don't want this guy. We still want Bruce. Get rid of this guy. So, which is, it's a bit difficult. But one of the things that Steve Harris used to say to me was, just don't worry about it. When Bruce was in the band, they were always asking for Paul to come back. he was in the band for years. Massive hits, the biggest. They're still asking for the original singer. So, in that way, it was a lot easier to take. I think for some fans, it's just difficult. It's your favorite band. Mm. It's your girlfriend. It's your brother. I mean, let's face it. As a mega fan, you'll go to sleep with Iron Maiden. You're in bed with Iron Maiden. You wake up with Iron Maiden. And you're wearing Iron Maiden. It's next to your skin. So, of course, there's a big change. It's something unfamiliar you've got to get used to. And I think it was difficult. I accepted that because I am a fan. I was an Iron Maiden fan and also a Kiss fan. And also I knew in one level what I was getting into. And I think Bruce could never have known this and never have predicted this because of the way that the band took off when he joined. And that is, every Kiss fan, every real Kiss fan, knows the name of every single ex-member of Kiss. And every real hardcore Iron Maiden fan knows the name of every single ex-member of Iron Maiden. They can name them. And I knew that going in, that when I was in there, no matter what happened in the future, and I still expected to be in there, I never expected to leave, that, you know, everyone, like it or not, would always know. Every real Iron Maiden fan would always know that I had been a part of Iron Maiden. And as a rocker and as a fan and someone who has put heavy metal music at the center of my life, then it's a huge amount of pride to have that. And when people say to me, oh, don't you get fed up that people still talk about you being in Iron Maiden? I go, well, still talk about me being like the world champion of singers. You know what I mean? Like being the number one that I, in my profession, there's no bigger job that you can aspire to than being the lead singer of the world's arguably greatest heavy metal band, singing The Trooper and Number of the Beast. You've been chosen to do that. So why not? Why would I ever want to forget that? Right. Why wouldn't that ever be something that is incredible? Mm-hmm. It's 5 years of my life that changed my life, that dictated the course, the rest of my life. And here I am now, at something like 23 years later, or something like this, and I'm still a professional singer, writing my own songs, but now I have my own small record company. I tour where I want to tour, do the things, and I meet the people that support me and say, thank you. So I'm living my dream because I came from this fantastic thing and had this wonderful experience. You know, as dark as some of those moments are, you can't live for that. You've got to go, wow, man, you know, I'm heavy metal. If whatever, you, if you cut me right now, it's red metal. It's not blood. So that's what bleeds out. You know what I'm talking about. So it's an incredible, incredible thing.
Did you ever talk to Bruce after you got the gig? Or...
Well, I knew Bruce before I knew Iron Maiden personally. We met in New York at one of these, I don't know if you remember, Concrete Foundation Forums. Yeah, those things. And we met there at a gig and had a couple of pints together. And we met another couple of times along the way. And when I got the gig, he sent me best wishes and sent me a case of different real ales, and which, thinking about, he sent me a case of different real ales, and then he developed the ale, which has become Trooper beer, and it's so famous now. And when I played in Brixton Academy, he sent me a gift package which contained a yellow brick. And I was like, a yellow brick. And he said, I hope this is one of the first big steps on your yellow brick road to success.
Wow.
How sweet,
that's
man.
Pretty cool.
Well, I mean, that's so cool.
Yeah.
And after Iron Maiden, then he's been so supportive. He had a radio show, rock radio show, and he had me on there. And, you know, for this latest album, I had a song called Escape Velocity. And the chorus is basically, I will fly. And my hands become my wings. It's part of the story, actually, of my album. And I got in touch with him and I said, can I use your flight simulator? Because he's got his own business where he trains pilots. Mm. That's his business outside of Iron Maiden, you know. And he said, yeah. And I mean, these are really expensive things. If you want to go and hire a flight simulator, right, man, you go get a loan. And and I went there and they just got the flight simulator going and the guy worked it all for me and made it look like I was flying the plane and everything. So he's been an incredibly supportive during and after Iron Maiden, and we've never had a bad word to say about each other.
That's classy.
At all. And if you ever see something that appears on the internet that it's a bad comment that I ever said about Bruce, it's an absolute lie. It's someone else that said it, that it's been attributed internet lies. I've never ever said a bad word. Why would I?
Sure.
Why would I? And it's been the same. There's a mutual respect there. And when we meet, we look at each other and we just start smiling. There's a telepathy there that, yeah, there's one of the other guys in the world that knows how tough this is.
No kidding, right?
Yeah.
Let's talk about how it ended for you, for me, and then I want to talk to you about your new record and stuff. Did you mentioned that you were writing for a third record yet?
Yes.
Did this reunion with Bruce and Adrian come out of the blue?
For me, it did. Really? Because I never really used social media at that time. It was the early days.
Agency, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it was the early days of social media, and I think it was just before Facebook, and most things were on forums and message boards in those days, and I never looked at those. One of the things that I've done in my professional life, and I know it sounds pretty dumb, but when I look at reviews, you know, I always get someone else to read reviews first, and then I only read the review if it's good.
Yeah.
So I just made this point because I would get upset about what people would say, and so I just go, you know what? I'll choose now. This is a decision that I'm making in my life. I'll choose only to believe good reviews. And that's it. And life's been so much easier since I did that, Chris.
Yeah.
Because in the end, the only review that really matters to me is what my fans say. Mm-hmm. And if my fans come to me and say, well, you know, I didn't like this one as much, or that's, the, you know, this, then that hurts, not in a personal way, but that I've let somebody down, mm-hmm. That trusted me. And so that's the thing that really inspires me to keep going and try and do the absolute best that I can and make these lyrics the best that I possibly can, and give meaning to simple things and find truth in unusual places is my fans. And on my last two albums, then I had great support from my management, and this is a difficult thing. I said, right, no press copies, no listening copies go out until the fans that have ordered this album have received it. When the fans have got the album, when my fans have listened to this album, then the journalists and press, that's when everybody else can listen to it. I'm very, very small. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm underground. I'm a cult artist. I don't need all of that exposure. I don't have to chase it. And so on the last two albums that I've done, I was able to do that.
That's right.
That my fans got the album first. They ordered it. They supported me. They didn't know what they were going to get, but they trusted me, and they got that album. And then I didn't give a shit what the reviews, what anybody says about it, because on the message board, that yeah, I really like this. This is my favorite song. Yes, this has worked. Yeah, that's it. That's because those are the people I did it for. Mm. They invested in it. Right. They're the ones, and I've always felt this from Dot in the Wolfsbane years, I always felt, and it was the horrible cash crop mentality of the 80s, where bands were signed to make one album, rock bands signed to make one album, do a ballad, rock ballad, and then never made another album. Or they were signed and their album stayed on a shelf. Mm-hmm. Imagine the pain, Chris, as an ambitious young man with your heart, your dream to be out there touring, to be writing, to recording for the thing that you've believed and loved to be on a shelf somewhere.
Unreleased.
Never to see the light of day. You have no control over it whatsoever. So that never sat well with me. Mm-hmm. And the way they used to talk about the fans, the kids, the punters, I never liked it. And one person who I won't name said about my lyrics, because I was agonizing with a couple of words. And in Maiden, it's a totally different story, mate. In Maiden, it's there is no censorship whatsoever on what you write. This would never happen in Maiden, but this was before Maiden, and this is why I'm so strong on it, that somebody said, never overestimate the intelligence of the fans.
Mm.
And I'm like,
yeah, the overestimate. So, yeah,
I'm a fan.
Yeah,
so I'm just a dumb $10 to you. That's it. I'm $10 in my pocket. As long as you get that off me, you don't care. Show me a nice picture. Tell me that something's great. Lie to me into getting, make me get that album, and then get something that just was not the best quality, was not the best songwriting, was not made well, or whatever. So it was, that always really stuck with me.
Sure.
In Maiden, it's a completely different thing. If you think about the way that Maiden write and the words that are used and everything, the particular word that we got hung up on was apparition, and it was in a song from Wolfsbane called Cathode Ray Clinic. apparition hot from hell. That comes from Hamlet, a play by Shakespeare. And it is at the start of that play when Hamlet is rudely awoken and the guards say, oh, we've seen the ghost of your dad. His dad's dead. What do you mean you've seen the ghost of my dad? He came at midnight. The ghost of your dad came at midnight. And Hamlet said, well, how can that be? And I said, well, you've got to come with us at midnight. And there is the ghost of his dad and the ghost of Hamlet's father, not to throw a spoiler on it because it's right at the beginning. If you've never seen Hamlet, then he says, I have been murdered and my death must be avenged. Because I'm in purgatory right now. I can't go anywhere because my death is not avenged. And that's the start of Hamlet. Mm-hmm. So going back a little bit, my song Cathode Ray Clinic is about TV. And it's about the things that we see on TV that come into our living room. And you know exactly what I'm talking about. TV goes into people's living room and that thing is actually with them in the room. So whether that is a horrific scene from the Vietnam War or from any war or some horrible, devastating terrorist attack, that's in your living room. And that was what I was doing. I was likening that, okay, an apparition hot from hell. Could be this terrorist attack that you see. Could be this terrible seeing something awful that's happened, you know, in reality. And what right have people got to put that into our living room and stuff like that? So anyway, the argument went on, have you got to use this word apparition? And you can imagine, as a Shakespeare fan, I'm born in Birmingham. I've seen almost every Shakespeare play in Stratford, the place of his birth. I'm like, you are kidding me. So that was it. In Maiden, you never get that. If you say, well, the chorus of this song says one thing, but I don't want that to be the title. Because with the title, I want to ask a question. So then you have to read the lyrics of the song. You have to listen to the lyrics to see how that unfolds. And Steve Harris would also, yeah, great. Sounds great. Really cool. He
trusted your judgment.
Yeah. And it's like, well, there's no thinking that people are stupid.
Mm-hmm.
There's nobody thinks that Iron Maiden fans are stupid. No one in Iron Maiden does anyway.
Yes, the band doesn't. Yes. But so we were talking about how you got the news that you were out of the band. Did you see it on a message board or something? They had that.
No, I what happened was, all done very well. I can't complain at all, Chris, about the whole thing. I was fired from the band. They called me to a meeting. I thought it was going to be about all the touring plans for next year, and it's... to cut a long story short, they said, you know, you're out of the band. And I said...
Is this Rod telling you that?
This is a full band meeting with Rod.
Okay.
You know, very serious, done absolutely the correct way that you could do something so, which for me, obviously, so horrible. And I said at that point, I said, well, is Bruce coming back? And really nobody could look me in the eye after that. And they said, yeah. I said, well, you know, what I will say to you now is that the world has to have Iron Maiden in it, and I'll still support this band and I'll never say a bad word about it. Mm. And I really wish you the best of luck. Iron Maiden has to continue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with or without me, there has to be an Iron Maiden in this world performing. It just has to be. It's like not having electricity.
Sure.
To not have Iron Maiden in the world.
But the thing about it, though, Blaze, and it's the same thing I talked to Bruce Kulick on this show, another great guy like you are, and he said when they said that they're reuniting with Ace and Peter, it's like, there's nothing I can say in a bad way. It's like, I get it. You know, that's kind of what the world has been waiting for,
yeah,
for Bruce and Adrian to be coming back to Iron Maiden.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's not like, yeah, you got sacked because you're an asshole or because you weren't doing your gig right. It's the only guy that kind of trumps you.
I think the one of the small things, it probably sounds a bit weird, I felt a little bit cheated that I never got the opportunity to write with Adrian.
Oh, yeah.
In the band, because Wasted Years is one of my very favorite Iron Maiden songs. I loved Adrian's style and his melodic style. So
I still think, for me, the Smith Dickinson songs are always the best.
Yeah, it does a certain edge to it.
Yeah, and the chemistry they have.
Yeah,
which is another thing I was thinking about when you talked about writing and Steve letting you write and needing you to write. Not only had he just lost Bruce, but Adrian a few years before, he lost his big co-songwriting. Bruce or Steve writes some, and yeah, Steve thinks write the others.
Yeah,
they're gone.
Yeah.
They need you to step up.
Yeah, and I'm you know, I suppose that's, you know, I'm very, very lucky that creatively I feel I was up to that. And as we got deeper into it and I started to understand the dynamic between Nico and Dave and Steve musically in the writing process, then I started to become much more excited for that third album. I'd got from my Silicon Messiah album, I'd got Born as a Stranger, which I thought was going to go great. Yeah. I thought Silicon Messiah would go great. I thought The Launch would go absolutely great. Stare at the Sun would go great. Those are all ideas that I'd written. I had the choruses, all the lyrics too. Little tiny bits of music that I was expecting would just be the third album that would make fans go, this is really the new Iron Maiden, isn't it? In the business, what had happened, EMI closed all the manufacturing facilities. Napster had offered Sony Music, they'd offered their MP3, you know, conversion thing to the mainstream music business. That had been rejected out of hand. And that's why Napster decided to make it a free thing for people to use, because the mainstream music business ever think, they were so arrogant. They never thought they would need that. And of course, by the time we got to the end of my second album, CD sales worldwide, all hard items, bits of plastic had just gone well down. So it wasn't just the fact of the income of Iron Maiden, it was actually EMI and the big record companies were all suffering. So commercial pressure came to say, look, Judas Priest have had a reunion, Black Sabbath had a reunion, Deep Purple have had a reunion. Yeah. They've all been a big success. Do you know what we think would be good?
Makes sense, though,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, yeah. You can't blame anybody for that. That's just business.
Yeah.
We live with that. You know, that's it. You eat because you do business, because you go to work and you do business. That's how you pay your bills. So, you know, you can't. It's horrible and it feels personal, but in the end, it's not personal. It's business.
Mm-hmm.
You just choose, do you want to be a victim or do you want to be the anti-hero like Mel Gibson in Mad Max 2 that comes back and says, if it's all the same to you, I'll drive that tanker.
But that's what you did. You drove the tanker. You mentioned all these great records that you did. I really like Silicon Messiah. But here we are now with Infinite Entanglement, and it's a three-part, very ambitious. We're going to go to the studio after this.
We're going
to play a character in this opera that you're writing.
It's huge. Explain. It's huge. It's ridiculous how big it is. And I think if I'd have realized at the start, maybe I wouldn't have taken it on. But it's some kind of dream, and not a dream in an aspirational way, but something that kind of leaked into me from the future and unwound and borrowed into my mind as I wrote a song for my best of album called Eating Children, which is about the solar system and the sun expanding into a red giant and consuming every planet in the solar system. So it came from that, and we had written the songs for this album Infinite Entanglement, and there were too many. And when I looked at it and I realized I hadn't got the time to record these songs, I started to think differently. I thought, actually, it's not one album, is it? In fact, this song right here, that is on part three of a trilogy. It's a beginning, a journey, and a resolution. And it's a full story. Now, coming from the past that I come from, where you didn't know when you were signed up to a record label, you didn't know if you were going to make another album. It was up to them.
Right.
They got you under contract and they said, we'll decide if you make five albums, but we'll also decide if you make one and then you get dropped and have no money and go to work a regular job again. So it was a bold decision. It's my own label called Blaze Bailey Recordings, and I have a wonderful manager at the time, and I said to him, this is three albums, and I want each album released on the first, on or about the 1st of March each year, and I want a tour in Europe in the spring each year to support these albums. And he goes, okay, that's your creative vision. That's what you want as an artist. Okay, let's try and do it. And it's been a huge amount of work, but it has actually worked. But because I am independent, even though I'm underground, I can say what my, I can set my own release date. And you know what it's like? You work back, you go, right, I'm releasing on the 1st of March. That means I artwork done there. Final mix is done right, there. Yeah. Final guitars recorded there. Vocals recorded there. Da, 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 da. Writing starts there. And that's it. And that's what we've done for the last 3 years. This one has been a huge...
No, the first one was called...
It's called Infinite Entanglement. Then second. Part two is Endure
and survive,
and I can't give you the title of the new one yet.
It's a bit of the one that we're still working on.
But I'll phone you with that.
But that's, so and you said like it's a huge undertaking. Have the fans been enjoying?
It's been even worse than I. It's worse in a good way than I could possibly imagine, because 2 weeks after the first one comes out, people have listened to it. They've said, "I want the second one now." I'm like, "What? No!" And it's a story about identity in the first part, about a man who does not know if he is human. And his consciousness, unknown to him, is downloaded into a machine body. He wakes up in a machine body. And then he has to decide, what does it mean to be human? I think as a human, I feel as a human, but I have a machine body. What is it to be human? And he has to find out what it is.
It's almost like Blade Runner.
It is. Yeah. Mainly, I'm a huge science fiction fan. Yeah. And the real part of the inspiration comes from the book, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Mm-hmm. It's vastly different to the film. You know, if you've read it, it really toys with reality and what your perception of being human and being real actually is. So it comes from that, really. And you have to decide for yourself what it is to be human. In many ways, in the modern world, you have to decide what it is to be human.
Right.
And are you worthy of respect or not? And what is it that makes you worthy? Are you a good person? You know, and it's my belief that we should all aspire to try to be good people and to help each other wherever we can help each other, and to avoid bad things and selfishness and greed. But that's the first part of that story. He wakes up on a spaceship, realizes he's on the other side. He's on a journey to the other side of the galaxy, to a new planet discovered by Kepler Space Telescope. And he realizes he has a machine body, and he has to decide, what is it to be human? That's the first part of the story. That's leaving Earth and going on this journey. The second part of the story, Endure and Survive, it's a journey of 1,000 years. There's no warp drive. There's no faster than light travel. It takes over 1,000 years to get to the nearest Earth-like planet. And so you've got to be alive. You've got to endure 1,000 years. You've got to survive at the end of it, because in the end of the story of Endure and Survive, they don't want him to get to the planet. It was never a part of their plan to allow this person to get to that new planet. He's actually been brought onto this mission to kill every other crew member, and their bodies are ground up and used as fuel for this ship. And there is genetically perfect DNA stored on that ship, which will grow new genetically perfect humans that will populate the new world, just as the conquistadors and all of the colonialists populated the new world and the new countries, just like they treated the Native Americans and the Aboriginals in Australia. It's it's a metaphor for that part of the story. So they tried to destroy him before he can get to that new world. They try to discard him and treat him as trash. Now he's not useful anymore. We'll throw you away.
So, and then the third part of this story
is starting now.
Right.
Is starting. What happens after that? Mm-hmm. At the end of this story, we leave him in space, clinging to the outside of a spaceship. He doesn't need to breathe air or oxygen. He just has to survive. He has turned his metal hands, his fingers into hooks and dug them into the side of that spaceship, and he's hanging on the outside of a spaceship as they get near the new world. That is the end of Endurance Survive.
So that's what goes.
Well, what is happening after that? Marcia, you better pre-order now to get it early. Yeah. You're going to find out then what is happening to him on part three. Of course, fans are going, what happens in part three? Don't tell me, they say. This is exactly it. That's what they say. What happens in part three? Don't tell me. I don't want to know. Don't spoil the surprise. But what happens?
Last couple of questions, Blaze. There was a tour that you did last year or 2 years ago, the Trinity tour with.
Oh, fantastic.
Tim Ripper Owens. Oh,
incredible.
Jeff
Tate. Incredible. Great guys.
Maiden.
Yeah. It was so much fun. So much fun.
Yeah.
And we loved it, man. And do you know Tim Ripper Owens? Yeah. I mean, he's
a great guy. He's like an American you.
He's the Bill Hicks of heavy metal. You know what I mean? He's so much fun to be out on tour with Tim. He's such a family guy as well. Yeah. He's just great, a great person to be around. Jeff Tate, lovely, lovely guy. And the way we worked out the show is we would do a bit and then hand over to the next singer and then hand over and then be on stage. We started the show together on stage and finished the show together on stage, and we all sang, you know, the hits of our various bands. And
what song did all three of you sing together?
We sang Living After Midnight.
Okay, great.
Yeah. Yeah, so that, which was really cool. Tim played guitar for that well. Yeah. So it was really cool.
Seems like in this day and age, when you're looking for a hook to draw people in, that would have been a good.
It was good, yeah. And we had a lot of interest from it, but I'm so committed to. I was already in the middle of my trilogy right then, and I just found some time at the end of my tour and rejigged my recording schedule so I could go and do that. And since then, I don't know, but people keep booking me. I just seem to be becoming more popular. I don't know why, but that's it. So we haven't found any more time
but
to
do that. But if you
find
the time, you would.
Yeah, it was just a fantastic experience. Mm-hmm. I'm so busy now, but I don't know why, but there's something about this trilogy being set in science fiction in a future that is believable, but it's still about you as a person. You coping with the difficulties of your everyday life, with the challenges that people throw at you, and with the lies and deceit that you often encounter in your life. And I know you know exactly, because your new single Judas is absolutely fantastic. I mean, the lyrics of that, man, are absolutely fantastic. It's also, oh no, this is strong stuff, man. This is really, really strong stuff. So you know what I'm talking
absolutely.
About the darkness that you face and that you're faced with from other people. You know, you meet so many people in life that will promise you everything and talk up this really great game, and then I think it's the classic thing of, well, you talk the talk, but will you walk the walk? Because that walk, man, is a tough, lonely, up at dawn, pride swallowing siege of a walk. And it's not everybody that's going to make it to the end.
Hey man, last question for you. What's your favorite song to sing of the songs from this trilogy live? And what's your favorite Maiden song to sing when you were in Maiden?
From so far from the trilogy, from the two that we've done, I really like a song that we do called Calling You Home. And it is the part of the story where he realizes now he's on a, it's a one-way mission. They always knew that, but the realization then comes to him.
Back.
Yeah, they knew that when they signed up for it, but now it's real because he's on the ship. And it's every night when we've done that on stage, you know, we've made a lot of friends and a lot of fans have had great support. And we dedicate that song to the fans every night. And we say, tonight we are calling you home, because the song says, I'm calling you home.
Right. Favorite Maiden song?
I think, you know, it varies, but you can't get away from the Clansman. You can't get away from it, Chris. It is something that will take on its own life at a gig.
It reminds me a lot of Fear of the Dark, and that it's such a better song live than it was in the record.
Yes,
it really
absolutely
comes alive.
Absolutely.
In a live
and
setting.
That's the song where fights break out at the gig. And I was in Belgrade, Serbia, and there were some big ex-army guys in the gig there. It was a pretty rough place that we were playing. It'd been moved to a venue that was basically just a room without windows underneath a restaurant. And it was just horrible, man. But the gig had to go on, you know, the show must go on, you know what it's like. You're there, you think, well, I'm not going to cancel. If it's possible to make it happen, we'll make it happen. And the stage is a bit wobbly and everything. And the set's going pretty well. I'm doing some of my own stuff. A couple, you know, like Lord of the Flies I've done for my X Factor album. And then we start the intro. To Clansman. And then you get to that first chorus. And of course, it goes, freedom! And these huge guys, man. Just huge ex-army guys. Just built like, I don't know what. And they're like, they just erupt. And the whole room just goes crazy. And you feel like, man, this is like a battle. This really is. These guys, you think, man, these guys have got post-traumatic stress disorder. They're back. They're in a firefight in the middle. They're, I don't know, doing what? They're facing certain, freedom, come on, over the door, let's go. And you think, what the hell? And we just looked at each other on stage and I'm like, are we going to get out of this alive? Is it going to be on CNN? Incident in Belgrade. Blaze Bailey Band dies after performing explosive version of Clansman. And you just don't know. You just don't know what's going to happen with it. You know, most of the time it goes really great and people are enthusiastic, but there are just odd occasions. I don't know if it's the weather or what it is, or just certain amount. Yeah, the BS. Yeah. Just a few elements that come together. And there's a couple of nights on the tour, you don't know where they're going to be, where that thing will just go crazy.
Yeah.
And you kind of dread doing it. You have to. You dread doing it. It's gorgeous to be able to sing, and I know what I want. It's just fantastic. Freedom. It's just incredible to sing it, man, to be a part of it and to have everybody singing it with you. Come on! And in a way, you become the Clansman, and I become possessed by this thing of, it is about someone seeking independence for themselves and their family and self-determination. And in a way, I'm outside of the mainstream music business. I'm outside of the big machine. I am the Clansman, seeking my own independence, seeking my own freedom for my music to live my own way and forget everything else that the music business says about, you should do it this way. Oh, that's not the way, the conventional wisdom. Well, forget the conventional wisdom. I don't care about that because I am the Clansman.
Oh, Blaze, you're great, man. That's great stuff. Let's go make a record.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. All right, you can get Blaze Bailey's new album, Infinite Entanglement Part 3,
at blazebailey.net. That's BLAZEBAYLEY.net. Of course, I am on one of the songs doing some backup vocals. Great time working with Blaze. It's the final album in the trilogy of albums he's been writing and recording over the last 3 years. He's also touring Europe this whole summer. Look for the dates. You get the ticket info also on his website. And of course, you can find him on Facebook at Official Blaze Bailey. And follow him on the Twitter at Real Blaze Bailey. And follow us at Jericho_Cruise, because there's still a few cabins available for Chris Jericho's Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea, setting sail October 27th for as low as $150. You can put a deposit, hold your cabin. And once you book, remember, everything is included in the booking price. All the food, all the activities, live podcasts, stand-up comedy, meet and greets, concerts, the chance to see Kenny Omega in the ring, Sea of Honor tournament, all covered, all inclusive, all for free when you book your cabin. The things you pay for on the ship, drinks and gambling. If you don't do neither, everything is all-inclusive. And you'll be able to come hang on the ship with all these guests. I'll be there. Jim Ross, Jerry Lawler, SoCal Val, Mick Foley, Noel Foley, Ricky Steamboat, Rey Mysterio, Raven, Cyrus Paul Lazenby from Killing the Town, Conan Disco Inferno, Shane Helms from Keeping It 100, Beyond the Darkness, Dave Schrader, Tim Dennis will be there telling some scary tales, scaring the pants off you. Cole Cabana, Marty DeRosa doing the Unprofessional Wrestling Show, Brad Williams, Ron Funches doing some hilarious stand-up comedy, Busted Open Radio, Dave LaGreca will be there, Corey Taylor of Slipknot will be there doing a performance, Fozzie doing performances, Phil Campbell, the Bastard Sons, King, The Stir from Atlanta, Dave Spivak Project, you heard him right here on Talk is Jericho, The Cherry Bombs, The Darlings of Rock and Roll, Shoot to Thrill, the world's greatest AC/DC cover band, Blizzard of Ozzy, the world's best Ozzy cover band, and of course, Ring of Honor, presenting the Sea of Honor tournament aboard the ship. Matches happening in the middle of the ocean. Winner of the Sea of Honor tournament gets a Ring of Honor World Heavyweight Championship shot in the future. Kenny Omega will be there. Young Bucks, Villain Marty Skrull, Briscoe Brothers, Dalton Castle, Kazarian, Adam Page, Chris Daniels, Jay Lethal, Cheeseburger, Deonna Purrazzo, Mandy Leon, Brandi Rhodes, Kelly Klein, Matt Taven, Flip Gordon, Delirious, Kenny King, Silas Young, the Beer City Bruiser, the Dogs, and of course, the American Nightmare, Cody, don't call him Rhodes. So much more to be added. We got some new announcements on April 23rd. The cruise is on pace to sell out. Don't be left behind, all right? Don't be left behind. Go to ChrisJerichoCruise.com. Be a part of history. The first ever Chris Jericho's Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea. The Regatta of Wrestling, it's coming October 27th, ChrisJerichoCruise.com. Don't you dare miss it, and we'll see you on that cruise. And coming up on Wednesday, another huge Talk is Jericho. Actually, I'm not going to announce it because this guy is going to be on the show as I reach down to pull my shoe on. There's a huge comedian. We lost Jim Brewer when he got hired by Metallica to open their next tour. That damn Lars, he got me. But the reasonable replacement of bigger value or better. We're going to announce it next week right here on Talk is Jericho. It's a secret. One of the funniest rock and roll comedians in the world. Let's leave it at that. He's going to be here on Wednesday. We'll see you then. In the meantime, in the between time, stay hard, stay hungry. Peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy. See you on Wednesday, baby.